Chicago and Boston to hear it. The evening began with a complaint, voiced in garbled, guttural English by City Coroner Hober, about the police board's attitude to the Continental Sunday. Commissioner Parker, also on the platform, had said immigrants were welcome to obey American laws.
"He has not got any business to welcome us, if ye are here by right."
Hober's language grew so incoherent as passion took him that even his fellow Germans laughed. But Roosevelt listened with grave courtesy. Before giving his own prepared speech, he dispelled the specter of ethnic prejudice quickly and bluntly.
"I care nothing for the birthplace of those whom I address. I speak as an American to fellow Americans."
There was a scattering of shocked applause. He was always at his best in situations of this kind. Something about united opposition stimulated his adrenaline and accelerated the natural rapidity of his mind. As he launched into the main body of his speech, beginning with a ferocious attack upon Senator Hill, he gave off a clean glow of health and strength. His skin stretched brown and taut around the muscular neck. His eyes shone clear blue through flashing pince-nez. He crouched slightly forward, as if posing for a spring. There was something canine about his eager alertness. A Chicago correspondent, searching for similes, tried Mastiff, but then settled on Greyhound crossed with a terrier.
"Senator Hill has done me the honor to take me as the antitype of his political methods and political views, and has singled me out for attack in connection with the excise law. Senator Hill's complaint is that I honestly enforce the law, which he and Tammany put on the statute books. His assault upon that honest enforcement is the admission, in the first place, that it never has been honestly enforced before, and in the next place, that he never expected it to be. It is but natural that he and Tammany should grow wild with anger at the honest enforcement of the law, for it was a law which was intended to be the most potent weapon in keeping the saloon's subservient allies to Tammany Hall. With a law such as this, enforced only against the poor or the honest man and violated with impunity by every rich scoundrel and every corrupt politician, the machine did indeed seem to have its yoke on the neck of the people. But we throw off that yoke, and no special pleading of Senator Hill can avail to make us put it on. Where justice is bought, where favor is the price of money or political influence, the rich man held his own, and the poor man went to the wall. Now, all are treated exactly alike."
With Commissioners Parker and Andrews nodding approval on either side of him, and applause mounting as his sincerity filled the room, Roosevelt argued that honest enforcement of an unpopular law was the most effective way to bring about its repeal. Legislators should think twice in future about passing laws to favor some voters, then neglecting them to please others. Abuse of the statute book was a mockery of civilization. Inevitably, it led to anarchy and violence. Using one of his typically brilliant, if far-fetched, analogies, he compared the excise phenomenon with the lynchings phenomenon in the Deep South. In each case, the tyranny of a small, powerful mob had brought about a perversion of the law. In each case, the authorities accepted the perversion on the grounds that it represented popular sentiment. To those who advised him to pay heed to the latter, Roosevelt cried,
"My answer is that I have to do with popular sentiment only as this sentiment is embodied in legislation."
Insisting that he was not against the Germans, nor the Catholics, but acting on behalf of all good Americans, he concluded emphatically,
"It is the plain duty of a public officer to stand steadfastly for the honest enforcement of the law."
It was a classic Roosevelt performance. Aggression, vehemence, frankness, and authority, expressed in sentences a child could understand. The applause was long and respectful, and he sat down looking exceedingly pleased with himself. Commissioner Parker rose to make a few remarks of support, and the evening ended with three hearty Teutonic cheers for the Reform Police Board. The Chicago correspondent went home to report that Theodore Roosevelt was undeniably the biggest man in New York, if not the most interesting man in public life. Among other superlatives lavished on Roosevelt next morning was a telegram from the venerable Senator George F. Hoar, patriarch of the Republican Party. "Your speech is the best speech that has been made on this continent for 30 years. I am glad to know that there is a man behind it worthy of the speech."
"That was pretty good of the old man, was it not?" Roosevelt exulted to Cabot Lodge. I was really greatly flattered. In the same letter, he acknowledged that his uncompromising attitude had sharply polarized the press. For a couple of months, virtually every newspaper in the city had eulogized him. But now, almost overnight, the World, Herald, Sun, Journal, and Advertiser are shrieking with rage, and the German-American Staatszeitung is fairly epileptic. He could still count on the support of the Tribune and Times, and also, to his ironic amusement, E.L. Godkin's Evening Post. However, I don't care a snap of my finger. My position is impregnable. I am going to fight whatever the opposition is. If the Yellow or Working Man's Press was shrieking, then its clamor rose to levels of real bedlam in the weeks that followed, as the weather grew hotter and the Sunday spigots ran drier. The World and Herald devoted page after full page to Teddy's folly, caricaturing him as a Puritan Dutchman bent on driving innocent citizens out of New Amsterdam. With such active encouragement, about 500,000 citizens did indeed leave town on Sunday, 21 July, to slake their thirsts in the country pubs of Long Island and New Jersey. They raised their tankards and drank many a bitter toast to Roosevelt's downfall, while Presbyterian ministers and temperance societies sang hymns to his praise. Controversy builds political stature, and Roosevelt saw no reason to be alarmed by the extremes of hostility and admiration his name seemed to arouse. Even the Commercial Advertiser saw that the most despised and at the same time the best-loved man in the country was destined for higher office. Will he succeed Colonel Strong as mayor, or Levi P. Morton as governor, or Grover Cleveland as president? Inspired by a midnight prowl on 23 July, which found every policeman on the Lower East Side patrolling with clockwork efficiency, Roosevelt announced that the following Sunday, the 6th of his campaign, would be the driest New York has ever known. His prophecy proved correct. One newspaper compared the metropolis to the Sahara. A few side doors were open for privileged customers, but the masses were obliged to go thirsty. Chewing gum boys reported record sales. Bums on the Bowery went into delirium tremens for lack of alcohol. One elderly lady was seen crossing over to Long Island City with an empty beer bucket. Fashionable neighborhoods were deserted, as all who could afford to left town for the day. Some well-to-do youths chartered a pleasure boat, recruited a band and a bevy of girls in white muslin, and cruised off to Idlewild Grove, towing two bargefuls of iced ale. Roosevelt, relaxing with his family at Oyster Bay, could not be reached for comment, but Commissioner Grant was in the city and expressed doubt that the poor were really suffering. "Everybody would get on beautifully in hot weather," he suggested, "if they would drink warm, weak tea." At midnight, a downtown saloonkeeper named Levy, who had studied the statute book and found that the hour from 12 p.m. Sunday to 1 a.m. Monday was not covered by any law, flagrantly opened his doors. Word traveled fast, and for the next hour saloons all over town were brilliant with lights and festivity. "Mr. Roosevelt is beaten," claimed the Sun next morning, but it was plain he was not. The very scrupulousness with which Levy had observed the letter of the law testified to the efficiency of the police department in executing it. As dry Sunday followed dry Sunday through the heat of August, public resentment of Roosevelt smoldered. The English poet John Masefield, then working as a potboy in a New York saloon, often heard men wondering how soon he would be shot. On 5 August, a clerk at the post office tore open a suspicious-looking package addressed to Roosevelt and was startled by a puff of flame and smoke. Miraculously, all that had exploded was a match fuse on the wrapper. Inside lay a live cartridge embedded in gunpowder. Roosevelt dismissed the letter bomb as a cheap thing and refused to look at it. The campaign went on. Roosevelt's astonishing national prestige, so at odds with his unpopularity in New York, continued to grow. "The whole country, it seemed, was talking about Theodore Roosevelt," wrote Avery Andrews. It liked what he was doing. Word of his exploits spread even to London, where the Times described him as a police Rhadamanthus, ruling Mulberry Street with undisputed sway. His three colleagues, especially the excellent Parker, were supporting him to a man, and Acting Chief Conlon, although nominally in independent control of the force, was content to obey his orders. Crimes were down, arrests up, corruption clearly on the wane. Roosevelt had every reason to congratulate himself, and did not hesitate to do so. Familiar signs of self-satisfaction appeared in his behavior. He began to talk in private as if he were on a platform, pausing after every sentence to watch its effect on the listener. His youthful love of flamboyant dress was revived in a summer outfit, the like of which had never been seen at police headquarters. It consisted of a straw English boater, a pink shirt, and a black silk cummerbund whose tasseled ends dangled down to his knees. Bustling, jocose, and rubicund, he would burst into board meetings and impulsively sweep up piles of documents awaiting action. "These relate to civil service matters. With the board's permission, I will decide them all." The word "I" invaded his speeches to such an extent that the Herald took to reproducing it in bold type. The effect on a column of gray newsprint was a buckshot at close range. The success of Roosevelt's crusade was helped by his early insistence that he was acting out of duty, not blue-nosed morality. But the temptation to preach, always strong in him, became irresistible on 7 August when he appeared at the Catholic Total Abstinence Union's National Convention in Carnegie Hall. Sharing the platform with him were Mayor Strong, Commissioner Parker, and a phalanx of clergymen headed by Archbishop Corrigan of New York. Big Tim O'Sullivan, a state senator from Tammany Hall, represented the forces of iniquity. After a mass chorus of "While We Are Marching for Temperance," sung to the tune of "Marching Through Georgia," Senator O'Sullivan rose to give the first speech. He had not joined in the singing, and proceeded to make plain his contempt for the Puritans' gloomy Sabbath. To an uproar of hisses and boos, he declared that the excise law discriminated against the orderly citizen who drinks in moderation, while encouraging the real drunkard to lay in supplies of hard liquor and souse in front of his family. Roosevelt's face during this speech was a study of majestic disapproval. Throwing aside his prepared text, he followed O'Sullivan to the lectern and soothed the raging audience with a full display of his teeth. "I want to express my gratitude to the Catholic Church," he intoned, "because it stands manfully for temperance and for a day of rest and innocent enjoyment." The next 30 minutes were devoted to conversational defense of himself and his policies, remarkable for the roars of applause that greeted every quiet cadence. For the most part, it was standard stuff, but Roosevelt inserted paragraphs of temperance rhetoric which worked his 7,000 listeners into a frenzy of righteous fervor. Senator O'Sullivan was mentioned only occasionally, in tones of sympathetic sorrow, as a lost sheep to be mourned by the rest of the flock. "Rub it into him, Teddy," yelled a voice, and Roosevelt swung into his peroration. "I hope to see the time when a man will be ashamed to take any enjoyment on Sunday, which shall rob those who should be dearest to him and are dependent on him of the money he has earned during the week. When a man will be ashamed to take a selfish enjoyment and not to find some kind of pleasure which he can share with his wife and children." "Never in my life," he wrote afterward, "did I receive such an ovation." It was fully 5 minutes before order could be restored. Commissioner Parker ran over to shake his hand, followed by a score of delighted priests. If the world is to be believed, Mayor Strong actually stood up and cheered, while State Senator O'Sullivan looked as uncomfortable as any man could possibly look. Reading the text of Roosevelt's speech 8 decades later, one is struck, as so often with his oratory, by the ordinariness of the language which aroused such enthusiasm. Yet the words, banal as they are arranged with consummate skill. At no point that evening did he espouse the doctrine of total abstinence. He made no specific condemnation of drink. Yet somehow, he managed to convince 7,000 die-hard prohibitionists that he was wholly on their side. Experts in the study of mass manipulation techniques could only shake their heads in admiration. "You are rushing so rapidly to the front," wrote Henry Cabot Lodge, "that the day is not far distant when you will come into a large kingdom." Roosevelt worked harder during the hot months of 1895 than ever before in his life. In addition to a grinding routine of 10- and 12-hour days, interrupted only by rare weekends at Sagamore Hill, he expounded his board's policy again and again in packed halls on the east side, with temperatures at boiling point, both as regards the weather and the audiences. Boos greeted his every appearance, but he exuded such charm, vigor, and sincerity flashing his teeth upon request and dancing polkas with the girls of the teetotum club, that he usually bowed out to cheers. Meanwhile, the Sunday closing crusade went on. More and more saloon keepers decided that their side door business was not worth the risk of heavy fines and/or loss of license. On 23 August, the Liquor Sellers Association, representing some 9,000 of the city's 12,000 saloons, came out in favor of total observation of the law and threatened to expel any members who failed to comply. Its motive, of course, was to make political pressure for repeal overwhelming, but nevertheless, the announcement was seen as a psychological victory for Roosevelt. Sunday, 1 September, replaced 28 July as the driest on record. "There has not been a more complete triumph of law in the municipal history of New York," wrote the London Times correspondent. Roosevelt had managed to achieve the impossible by closing the saloons and getting large crowds of poor people to respect him for it. He himself boasted that he had never had such a success as in the last 4 months, adding the usual disclaimer, "I am not a bit taken in, and shall not be in the least disappointed when it ends." He scored yet another publicity coup on 25 September, when the United Societies for Liberal Sunday Laws staged a protest parade through Germantown and sent him a cynical invitation to attend. Few imagined that he would accept. When Roosevelt came drumming up the steps of the reviewing stand on 86th Street, Hermann Ritter, publisher of the Staatszeitung, was convinced he was an imposter. "I'll go bail he is the genuine article," laughed the city controller. The parade, which took 2 hours to pass by, was a spectacular demonstration of Teutonic irony. Flagstaffs and building facades were draped with purple bunting, symbolizing the death of the Continental Sunday. The advance guard consisted of a dozen bicyclists with blue noses and bunches of whiskers under their chins, impersonating upstate hayseed legislators. Some 30,000 marchers followed on in leather trousers, Bismarck helmets, and other ethnic paraphernalia. Saloon keepers rolled by in open carriages, waving bottles of Rhine wine, and a poster declaiming, "Taint Sunday." A gilt wagon carried a pretty Fraulein veiled in black as the morning goddess of liberty. She looked bewildered when Roosevelt loudly applauded her. Another float, labeled the Millionaire's Club, showed three dress-suited toffs, one with prominent teeth and spectacles, swigging champagne while behind them two policemen arrested a beer drinker in working clothes. As this float passed, reported the World, Mr. Roosevelt looked serious. For most of the afternoon, however, he beamed with enjoyment. Since he stood on the most prominent part of the platform, it seemed as if the whole affair were in his honor. Word of his presence spread back down the line, and the paraders twisted their necks to stare at him. One short-sighted veteran peered at the stand and shouted, "Wo ist der Roosevelt?" The commissioner leaned forward, thumping his chest, and screamed, "Hier bin ich!" At this, the marchers, spectators, and everybody on the stand dissolved into helpless laughter. "Teddy, you're a man!" yelled someone in the crowd. Afterward, Roosevelt told his hosts he had never had such fun. "But," he added, "100 parades can't swerve us from doing our duty." With that, he left, carrying two souvenir banners for the wall of his office: Roosevelt's razzle-dazzle reform racket, and "Send the police czar to Russia." Roosevelt's public triumphs in the summer and early fall of 1895, coupled with his tireless campaigning on behalf of his board and his party, prompted rumors that he was actively working toward the nation's highest office. The commercial advertiser's above-quoted suggestion that he might succeed Grover Cleveland as president was taken up by the Ithaca Daily News, which formally endorsed him for the Republican nomination in 1896. In Brooklyn, a certain Reverend A.C. Dixon proclaimed from the pulpit the hope that Theodore Roosevelt might soon enter the White House, as he incarnates the principles upon which government is founded. At number 303 Mulberry Street, Jacob Riis serenely countered all criticism of the commissioner's high-handed actions with, "Of course, Teddy is bound for the presidency." What was more, said Riis, Teddy knew it. "Let's ask him," Lincoln Steffens suggested. The two men dashed across to headquarters and burst into Roosevelt's office. Riis put the question directly. Was he working to be president? The effect, wrote Steffens, was frightening. T.R. leaped to his feet, ran around his desk, and fists clenched, teeth bared, he seemed about to throttle Riis, who cowered away amazed. Don't you dare ask me that, T.R. yelled at Rhys. Don't you put such ideas into my head. No friend of mine would ever say a thing like that. You... Rhys's shocked face, or T.R.'s recollection that he had few friends as devoted as Jake Rhys, halted him. He backed away, came up again to Rhys, and put his arm over his shoulder. Then he beckoned me close, and in an awed tone of voice, explained, Never, never, you must never, either of you, remind a man at work on a political job that he may be president. It almost always kills him politically. He loses his nerve. He can't do his work. He gives up the very traits that are making him a possibility. I, for instance, I am going to do great things here, hard things that require all the courage, ability, work that I am capable of. But if I get to thinking of what it might lead to... He stopped, held us off, and looked into our faces with his face screwed up into a knot, as with lowered voice he said slowly, I must be wanting to be president. Every young man does, but I won't let myself think of it. I must not, because if I do, I will begin to work for it. I'll be careful, calculating, cautious in word and act, and so I'll beat myself, see? Again he looked at us as if we were enemies. Then he threw us away from him and went back to his desk. Go on away now, he said, and don't you ever mention that to me again. Rhys and Steffens were so crestfallen that afterward they did not even mention it to each other. Yet Roosevelt himself could hardly ignore the specter they had raised. He could not stop people addressing him, quite correctly, as President Roosevelt, and he would have been less than human had his heart not lurched sometimes at the sound of that phrase. The November elections approached, bringing with them some wintry blasts of political discontent, all seemingly directed at Roosevelt. His anti-corruption crusade had been tolerated by the state Republican organization as long as it contributed to the decline of Tammany Hall, but now it began to look as if the reverse effect might be true. There was an ominous contrast between rural and metropolitan voter registrations, the former promising a statewide sweep for the GOP, the latter indicating a Democratic backlash in New York City. Evidently, the world's constant presentation of Roosevelt as a reformer gone mad was having its effect. The Staatszeitung, ignoring his happy appearance at the Liberal Laws Parade, accused him of having a grudge against Irish Americans and German Americans. Republican pollsters computed the potential vote loss in each of these communities and blanched. They were not encouraged by Roosevelt's announced intention to police the election fairly. A less virtuous commissioner might have been persuaded to influence the voting by a combination of intimidation and selective arrests. But that kind of loyal assistance could hardly be expected from the patron saint of dry Sundays. Accordingly, the Republican convention at Saratoga endorsed the excise law in the vaguest possible terms, hoping to offend neither upstate rural prohibitionists nor thirsty urban workers. Pressure began to build on Roosevelt to moderate his crusade, at least through Election Day. His response was unequivocal and publicly expressed. The implication is that for the sake of the Republican Party, a party of which I am a very earnest member, I should violate my oath of office and connive at lawbreaking. Personally, I think I can best serve the Republican Party by taking the police force absolutely out of politics. Our duty is to preserve order, to protect life and property, to arrest criminals, and to secure honest elections. I shall not alter my course one hand's breadth, he wrote a worried Cabot Lodge, even though Tammany carries the city by 50,000. This intransigent attitude had immediate personal consequences. Edward Lauterbach, chairman of the Republican County Committee, issued a statement that the party was not in any way responsible for Rooseveltism. Lemuel Quigg, who had backed him for mayor the year before, reproached him for base ingratitude and said their friendship was at an end. He is a goose, Roosevelt commented indifferently. Even Mayor Strong, anxious to placate the German-American lobby, said he should either let up on the saloon or quit his post. Roosevelt replied that he would do neither. Strong was enraged, but powerless. Roosevelt put on a cheery front in public, but privately he was depressed by the sudden downturn of his political fortunes. It became increasingly apparent that the city's Republican voters were going to bolt in droves and that he would be held to blame. His support on the police board began to erode. There is considerable irritation, the World reported, Because Messrs. Parker, Grant, and Andrews have seemingly lost their identity and merged into the great and only Theodore Roosevelt. He admitted having some rough times with his colleagues.
It has only been by a mixture of tact, good humor, and occasional heavy hitting that I have kept each one in line.
With the abnormal self-control that always restrained his abnormal pugnacity, Roosevelt managed to avoid an open fight with state party leaders. He knew that the organization could not do without his unique talents as a campaigner. Anxious to reaffirm his party loyalty, he stumped for Republican candidates all over the city, speaking two or three times a night, and made side trips to local hustings in Boston and Baltimore.
"I am almost worn out," he wrote on his 37th birthday. "Thank heaven there is only a week more, and then the exhausting 6 months will be over, and I can ease up a little, no matter which way the battle goes."
The battle went to the enemy. Although Republicans won overwhelmingly elsewhere in the state, Tammany Hall saw its full slate of municipal candidates elected by landslide margins. Analysis of the polls showed that 80% of the German-American vote, hitherto solidly Republican, had gone Democratic. There could hardly have been a more crushing indictment of reform in general, and police reform in particular. The contrast between local and state returns only emphasized Roosevelt's unpopularity in his native city. He reacted with oblique rage. On 5 November, the same night the returns came in, he wrote to one of his Civil War heroes, General James Harrison Wilson,
"If I were asked what the greatest boon I could confer upon this nation was, I should answer an immediate war with Great Britain for the conquest of Canada. I will do my very best to bring about the day. I want to drive the Spaniards out of Cuba. I want to stop Great Britain seizing the mouth of the Orinoco. If she does it, then as an offset, I want to take the entire valleys of the St. Lawrence, the Saskatchewan, and the Columbia."
Next morning, he called in his precinct captains and told them that
"the board will not tolerate the slightest relaxation of the enforcement of the laws, and notably of the excise law."
But for all this bluster, it was plain his authority had been dealt a mortal blow. Even the loyal New York Times doubted that he would ever again mobilize the police as effectively as he had during the long, dry summer of 1895. The year drew to a close amid rumors that Mayor Strong had formally asked for Roosevelt's resignation. Both men denied the stories, but Strong was heard to complain at a public banquet,
"I thought I would have a pretty easy time until the police board came along and tried to make a Puritan out of a Dutchman."
The remark was supposed to be jocular. Strong fancied himself as an amateur comedian. But Roosevelt, sitting at the same table, did not find it at all funny. The pace of his grinding labor at police headquarters did not slacken. If anything, it increased, for he was trying to finish the neglected fourth volume of The Winning of the West in between appointments, as well as working full-time on it at weekends.
"I should very much like to take a holiday," he confessed, but felt too insecure in his job to leave town for long.
Friends worried about his health, emotional and physical. "He has grown several years older in the last month," William Sturgis Bigelow wrote Henry Cabot Lodge. "At this rate, it is only a question of time when he has a breakdown, and when he does, it will be a bad one. We shall lose one of the very few really first-class men in the country." Roosevelt's spirit sank lower as his reserves of physical strength dwindled. "It really seems that there must be some fearful shortcoming on my side to account for the fact that I have not one New York City newspaper nor one New York City politician of note on my side. Don't think," he reassured Lodge, "that I even for a moment dream of abandoning my fight. I shall continue absolutely unmoved from my present course and shall accept philosophically whatever violent end may be put to my political career." One person who met him during these dark days was Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. After watching Roosevelt in action at a literary dinner table, and afterward dispensing summary justice in the police courts, Stoker wrote in his diary, "Must be president someday. A man you can't cajole, can't frighten, can't buy."
Chapter 20. The Snake in the Grass.
Eric, the son of Hakon Jarl, a death drink salt as the sea, pledges to thee, Olaf the King.
The election of 1895, which cast such sudden shadows over Theodore Roosevelt, threw contrasting beams of light on an old man he had long managed to ignore,
but would have to reckon with in future. Thomas Collier Platt was now, after years of powerful obscurity, the undisputed Republican manager of New York State, and a major force in the upcoming presidential contest. The easy boss, as Platt was known for his patient, courteous manner, had entered politics before Roosevelt was born. In 1856, he had been a campaign troubadour for John Charles Fremont, the Republican Party's first presidential candidate. He had become a congressman in 1872, when little Teddy was still stuffing birds on the Nile. He was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1881, about the same time young Theodore first ran up the steps of Morton Hall. Since then, the careers of the two men, a quarter of a century apart in age and diametrically opposed in personality, had intertwined with a closeness remarkable for the fact that they seemed never to have actually met. Fortune spotlighted now one, now the other after Roosevelt's election to the New York State Legislature in 1881. Platt was then suffering his darkest hour, having resigned from the Senate in support of boss Roscoe Conkling's patronage stand against President Garfield. He had failed at re-election and withdrew into the wings just as Roosevelt took his bow in the Assembly. During the years that followed, Platt worked quietly offstage to assume control of the state Republican organization. In 1884, he had been one of the New York delegates to the Chicago Convention. While Roosevelt campaigned for Edmunds, Platt campaigned for Blaine, seconding his nomination and dispersing large amounts of boodle on his behalf. He and Roosevelt had joined forces in making Blaine's nomination unanimous on the final day, but the older man's triumph was the younger man's humiliation. Then it was Roosevelt's turn to retire from public life, while Platt continued his takeover of the organization. 2 years later, when Roosevelt ran for mayor, Platt reluctantly put his machine to work for him. He was disgusted at the boy candidate's defeat. Like Roosevelt, he preferred not to recall that disaster in later years. Platt's political luster faded again in 1888, when Benjamin Harrison allegedly promised him a cabinet post in return for campaign help, only to forget about it after the election. Instead, the easy boss had the chagrin of seeing Roosevelt made civil service commissioner and go on to publicize a cause for which he, Platt, had nothing but contempt. For the next 6 years, he had watched Roosevelt's progress with disapproval, tempered by a certain amount of professional respect. It had been Platt's organization that swept William Strong into office in 1894, and he was none too pleased when the mayor appointed Theodore Roosevelt as police commissioner. Platt wished to use the police board, in its capacity as board of elections, to gerrymander the city, as he already had the state. But Roosevelt's gritty idealism began to interfere with the smooth workings of his machine. Roosevelt, in turn, declared that he was astounded at Platt's success in identifying himself with the worst men and worst forces in every struggle, so that a decent man must oppose him. A confrontation between boss and commissioner was therefore inevitable. Both men, in effect, had been preparing for it for 11 years, but they waited until the 1895 election to determine who would have the upper hand. Even then, Platt bided his time. With both houses of the legislature now firmly under control, he was gearing up his organization for the most massive gerrymander in American history, in which the eradication of a Theodore Roosevelt would be merely incidental. Platt's ambition was to combine old New York, Manhattan and the Bronx, with Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island into the metropolis of Greater New York. This would automatically double his powers of patronage. The present police department would be abolished, along with those of fire and health, and replaced by metropolitan commissions, which he would pack with organization appointees. It went without saying that under such legislation, the side-door saloons would flourish once more, but on behalf of the Republican Party for a change. Roosevelt had no immediate doom to fear from the Greater New York Bill, for the earliest consolidation date would be 1 January 1898. But then he began to hear rumors that Platt was drawing up a supplementary bill which would legislate him out of office long before that. Unable to stand the suspense, he asked his old friend and organization contact, Joe Murray, to arrange an interview with the easy boss. Early in the new year, word came back that Platt would see him in the Fifth Avenue Hotel on Sunday, 19 January, 1896. Like the Lord, Platt was wont to receive the faithful and hear their supplications on the Sabbath. This was not due to any Messiah complex on his part. Sunday was simply the most convenient day for out-of-town legislators, big businessmen, and overworked police commissioners to visit him. Still, there was something quaintly religious about the little knot of worshippers that gathered every seventh day outside his sanctuary. Regular attendants like Quig, Smooth Ed Lauterbach, and Chauncey Depew were nicknamed Platt's Sunday School Class. After seeing the old man, they settled on plush sofas at the end of the corridor to await his decisions. This niche was called the Amen Corner, on the grounds that no other response was possible once Platt had made up his mind. Presidents Lincoln, Grant, Hayes, Garfield, Arthur, and Harrison had all sat here, as well as James G. Blaine, who, in Platt's opinion, ought to have been president. Roosevelt might have been excused some feeling of trepidation in following such august predecessors. If not, the sight of the easy boss was enough to give any young man pause. Platt was then in his 63rd year, and moved, when he moved at all, with the painful majesty of arthritis. Tall, stooped, bearded, and murmuring, he looked like some political Rip Van Winkle who had fallen asleep in a more leisurely age and had woken to find the new one not much to his liking. His handshake was loose, his jaw slack, even his skin seemed tired. It creased down on either side of his nose and drooped in parchment-like folds over his large, sad eyes. Oddly enough, for a man whose desk was always piled with dusty papers and pamphlets, Platt was the perfection of elegance in dress. His suit rippled into place as he rose on his cane. A pearl pin glowed in his silk cravat, and high-starched collars scratched against his silvery jowls. Roosevelt was not deceived by this world-weary image, for Platt was known to be as tough in mind as he was frail in body. After some brief discussion of national affairs, the equivalent among state politicians of talk about the weather, the commissioner asked point-blank if he was to be kicked out by supplementary legislation after the Greater New York Bill had passed. Platt's reply was equally direct. Yes. Roosevelt could expect to be unemployed in about 60 days. Afterward, Roosevelt searched for adjectives to describe the interview. It was, he decided, entirely pleasant and cold-blooded. He also decided that since he was now in a fair fight for survival, he would pick up Platt's gauntlet in public. It so happened that the following morning, 20 January, he was due to address the New York Methodist Ministers Association at 155th Avenue. Knowing they were sympathetic to his crusade against the saloons, Roosevelt shrewdly presented himself as Christianity's last hope in Gomorrah. The other day, the most famous gambler in New York, long known as one of the most prominent criminals in this city, was reported as saying that by February, everything would again be running wide open. In other words, that the gambler, the disorderly housekeeper, and the law-breaking liquor seller would be plying their trades once more. Undoubtedly, there are many politicians who are bent on seeing this. They will bend every energy to destroy us because they recognize in us their deadly foes. The politician who wishes to use the police department for his own base purposes, and the criminal and the trafficker in vice, are quite right in using every effort to drive us out of office. It is for you decent people to say whether or not they shall succeed. If he had unveiled a giant effigy of Boss Platt with horns and a tail, he could not have more effectively mobilized the ministers. Convinced that Armageddon was at hand, they hurried off to denounce the easy boss from pulpits all over the city. The Methodist lobby in Albany warned legislators of disastrous consequences politically if they pursued the foolish and wicked course of punishing a public servant for doing his duty. Other ecclesiastical, liberal, and independent Republican organizations added their voices, and within 48 hours, the popular outcry against Platt was deafening. "Roosevelt's a nervy fellow, isn't he?" said Mayor Strong admiringly. Strong was beginning to regret his earlier jibes and threats against Roosevelt, perhaps because he realized that the commissioner, however controversial, was his only really distinguished appointment. He may also have pondered Richard Croker's widely quoted remark, "Roosevelt is all there is to the Strong administration, and Roosevelt will make it or break it." At any rate, the mayor was effusive in his approval of Roosevelt's speech, and announced that he would resist any moves against the present police board. On 23 and 24 January, the New York Times published full details of the Republican plot to oust Roosevelt, identifying Platt and his lieutenants by name, and denouncing them as contemptible, sneaking cowards and hypocrites. The effect of these front-page, double-column articles was to give chapter and verse to Roosevelt's allegations and draw national attention to the threat of a party split in New York. Platt was severely embarrassed. If he wished to be a force at the upcoming Republican National Convention, he must at all costs preside over a united delegation. His anti-Roosevelt bill was accordingly withdrawn from the legislature, although it was understood it could be revived at any time. Roosevelt said he was delighted to have been reprieved, but carefully refrained from making any further attacks on Boss Platt. "I shall not break with the party," he confided to Lodge. "The presidential contest is too important." Commissioner Andrews also expressed very great pleasure, and Commissioner Grant rumbled something to the same effect. Only Commissioner Parker was silent. Coincidentally or not, Roosevelt now discovered that he had an open enemy on the police board. A friendly newspaper editor had long ago warned that Andrew D. Parker was a snake in the grass, and sooner or later he will smite you. But Roosevelt was so taken in by the man's sinister efficiency, he had never really believed it. A Republican ward worker had also informed him that Parker could not be trusted, that he was not loyal to him as head of the commission. Roosevelt laughed. "Not loyal to me? Impossible. Why, only yesterday I boxed with him, and he boxes like a gentleman." True, there had been an occasion in October 1895 when he heard rumors that Parker was criticizing the Dry Sunday campaign behind his back while praising it to his face. More recently, Parker had several times lied to him with such brazen effrontery as to leave Roosevelt speechless. Yet there had been no direct hostility at board meetings, not that Parker attended many, and the department continued to operate smoothly well into the new year. Not until 5 weeks after Roosevelt's successful appeal to the Methodist ministers did the snake rear up and strike for the first time. At a routine board meeting on 28 February 1896, Roosevelt brought up the routine subject of promotions. Due to mass resignations over the past 9 months by corrupt officers anxious to escape criminal investigation, the force was studded with acting inspectors, captains, sergeants, and roundsmen. The commissioners acted periodically to make at least some of these promotions permanent, and there had been little dissent as to which officers deserved full rank and pay. Thus, when Roosevelt moved the promotions of acting inspectors Nicholas Brooks and John McCullough, two men known for their decency and efficiency, he doubtless expected the usual unanimous vote. But Commissioner Parker demurred. There were other officers, he said, just as worthy of advancement. For example, an excellent man in the Detective Bureau, which he, Parker, had just finished reorganizing. Roosevelt protested in dismay. Brooks and McCullough had been acting now for 9 months. The force was expecting their immediate promotion. It was not keeping faith with the men to delay matters any longer. He insisted that the motion be voted on. Commissioners Andrews and Grant added their eyes to his. Commissioner Parker refused to vote at all. Had the motion been on some trivial item of agenda, such as the issuance of a mask ball license or the sale of a police horse, Parker would have been overruled by the majority. But on matters of promotion, the board's Polish constitution required a full vote of 4, or 3 votes plus the written approval of Chief Conlon. Roosevelt was puzzled and frustrated. He did not like to resolve a board dispute by enlisting the aid of a man in the ranks. However, since Parker was adamant and remained absent from the next few meetings, the other commissioners had no choice but to summon Conlon before them on 12 March. They were confident that he would be agreeable. Unlike his formidable predecessor, Chief Burns, Conlon was a quiet, unassuming officer who generally did what he was told. Roosevelt asked bluntly if he would recommend the promotion of Brooks and McCullough. Conlon replied that he would not. What was more, the chief went on, he would no longer tolerate promotions or assignments within the force unless they were submitted to him in advance. He had not exercised this, his legal right, in the past, but in future he would insist upon it. It was evident to the three flabbergasted commissioners that they were listening to the voice not of Peter Conlon, but of their absent colleague. For some reason, Parker wished to stop the reorganization of the force, and by some power he had been able to recruit Conlon as his ally. Whatever his motives, the consequences threatened to be serious. Already the failure of Roosevelt's 28 February motion was having its effect on police morale. Some acting officers, pessimistic of advancement under a deadlocked board, refused to act at all until they got job security. Those who did try to give orders found the lack of gold on their sleeves acutely embarrassing. The commissioners were obliged to pass a resolution on 13 March, ordering Conlon to make a formal reply to their request in writing, as required by law. That very evening, Parker was due to dine with Roosevelt at 689 Madison Avenue, in response to a long-standing invitation. Under the circumstances, a note expressing polite regrets might have been understandable, but none was forthcoming, and at the appointed hour, Parker coolly showed up. It is unlikely either he or his host so much as mentioned the Brooks-McCullough affair. Their social relations were still cordial, and both men were too well-bred to argue over the dinner table. Besides, there were four other guests, including the Reverend Charles H. Parkhurst, president of the Society for the Prevention of Crime, and Roosevelt's good friend Joseph Buckland Bishop, an editor of the Evening Post. The subjects discussed were mainly political: Platt, Tammany, reorganization, political treachery, the German vote, etc. Roosevelt must have hogged the conversation as usual, for Parker was in an ill humor by the end of the evening. Walking home with Bishop, he suddenly said, "I wish you would stop him talking so much in the newspapers. He talks, talks, talks all the time. Scarcely a day passes that there is not something from him in the papers, and the public is getting tired of it. It injures our work." Bishop laughed. "Stop Roosevelt talking? Why, you would kill him. He has to talk. The peculiarity about him is that he has what is essentially a boy's mind. What he thinks, he says at once, says aloud. It is his distinguishing characteristic, and I don't know as he will ever outgrow it. But with it he has great qualities which make him an invaluable public servant: inflexible honesty, absolute fearlessness, and devotion to good government which amounts to religion. We must let him work his way, for nobody can induce him to change it." Parker received this speech in cold silence. At noon the following day, Roosevelt telephoned Bishop and invited him to lunch. In the latter's words, "As soon as we were seated at a narrow table, he leaned forward, bringing his face close to mine, and with appalling directness said, 'Parker came into my office this morning and said, "You think Bishop is a friend of yours, don't you?" "Yes," I replied. "Well, you know what he said about you last night. He said you had a boy's mind, and it might never be developed." Roosevelt's eyeglasses were within 3 inches of my face, and his eyes were looking straight into mine. Knowing my man, I did not flinch. "Roosevelt, I did say that. Did he tell you what else I said?" "No, that is what I want to hear." When I told him, he brought his fist down on the table with a bang, exclaiming, "By George, I knew it!" "There, Roosevelt," said I, "is your snake in the grass, of which I warned you, the meanest of mean liars who tells half the truth." If nothing else, this incident served to prove Parker's duplicity to Roosevelt. He reacted as he always reacted, aggressively, but as in a nightmare, found that he had no weapon to wield, no target to hit. Parker continued to stay away from board meetings, and when Roosevelt rescheduled some to suit his convenience, maddeningly stayed away from those too. Meanwhile, Chief Conlon ignored the board's order to report on Brooks and McCullough, saying that the commissioners must resolve their own differences. Roosevelt promptly appealed to the Corporation Council for an interpretation of the law, and was told that Parker and Conlon were perfectly within their rights. They could block every major decision of the board for the rest of the century if they chose. On 24 March, headlines in the yellow press began to mock Roosevelt's impotence. "His the voice of authority, but Parker's the hand that holds the rod." Considerable space was devoted to analyses of the deadlock at Mulberry Street that spring, and as reporters did their research, some interesting facts came to light. It transpired that Parker had begun to amass power in the department from the day he took office, quietly establishing control over the Detective Bureau, the most feared in the world outside of Scotland Yard. He now enjoyed as much potential influence in the underworld as Chief Burns had ever done. Just what use, if any, he intended to make of it remained to be seen. His hold over Chief Conlon was traced back to a bargain struck between them the previous year. Apparently, Parker had withheld his vote confirming Conlon until that officer was so desperate for permanent rank he had consented to pay the price, a promise of cooperation in any future moves against Roosevelt. Speculation as to Parker's long-term motives ranged 360 degrees around the political spectrum.
The Herald noted that Parker and Conlon were both Democrats, and that in the wake of Council's ruling they had already begun to change the structure of the precincts, with a fine eye for political detail. Mr. Parker is calculating the possibilities and probabilities of future elections and future legislatures. Should there ever be a one-headed commission, and the Democrats in the ascendancy, his friends say, he may be that commissioner. The Evening Sun believed that, on the contrary, Parker was cooperating with Boss Platt, who, unable to kill Roosevelt with legislation, had crossed party lines in order to cripple him. Parker's reward, presumably, would be some plum job when Greater New York came into being. Other papers speculated that Parker was working for Boss Jimmy O'Brien of the County Democracy, or alternatively, Boss Richard Croker of Tammany Hall. But Lincoln Steffens, writing in the Evening Post, saw the whole thing as a simple clash of personalities. It is impossible that two men like Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Parker should long travel the same road. They run on radically divergent tracks. Mr. Parker fights secretively, by choice, while Roosevelt seeks the open. Parker rushes swiftly to the punishment of any man. Roosevelt seeks ever a chance to reward and praise. Both are able and obstinate men. They were foreordained to disagree, and they did. It is idle to say that there is even a semblance of peace in Mulberry Street. There is war, and nothing but war, in prospect. Roosevelt would have welcomed a war of any sort during those early months of 1896. His preference, he confessed to Bammy, ran to the foreign variety. The nation was caught up in great excitement over President Cleveland's Venezuela message, and pressures were mounting for Congress to recognize the rebellion in Cuba. Roosevelt vigorously championed both causes. He sent a letter of congratulation to the president and received a long, grateful response. Cleveland, however, seemed unwilling to venture into the Caribbean, much to Roosevelt's disgust. "We ought to drive the Spaniards out of Cuba. It would be a good thing, in more ways than one, to do it." His frustrations over the police board deadlock vented themselves in a series of speeches, articles, and open letters aimed at the peace-at-any-price men, or more specifically, beings whose cult is non-virility. The editors of the Harvard Crimson were assailed for their spirit of eager servility toward England, and sternly reminded that John Quincy Adams, the real formulator of the Monroe Doctrine, had been a Harvard man. Students at the University of Chicago were warned that the adult world was rough and bloody, but if you have enough of the lust of battle in you, you will have a pretty good time after all. Elsewhere in the Windy City, in a major address to mark Washington's birthday, he thundered his gospel, "Life is strife," against a backdrop of stars and stripes. "There is an unhappy tendency among certain of our cultivated people," Roosevelt went on, "to lose the great manly virtues, the power to strive and fight and conquer." He urged his audience, in the name of Washington, to be ready for the day when America had to uphold its honor by an appeal to the supreme arbitrament of the sword. The non-virile, in reply, made amused reference to his failure to conquer anyone at police headquarters. "When a man of marked ability is obviously uncomfortable where he is," wrote a correspondent of the Evening Post, "it is a satisfaction to find some place where his energies will have unchecked swing." The writer suggested that Roosevelt should leave immediately for South Africa, where the Boers, Dutchmen pure and simple, were fighting a losing battle for control of the Transvaal. "Let him shake from his feet the dust of ungrateful Manhattan, let him offer himself as general-in-chief to President Kruger, and head the staunch conservatives who hold the fort from the Vaal to the Limpopo. Perhaps he may succeed in rolling back the British aggressor." E.L. Godkin, editor of the Post, agreed that this was an excellent idea. "Speaking for the American public, we say that, much as we esteem Mr. Roosevelt as a police commissioner, we think his value to the community would be greatly increased if somehow he could somewhere have his fill of fighting." After two or three campaigns for Kruger, he would be purged and would be able to resume the life of a dedicated public servant. In barbed sentences that seemed to have embedded themselves in Roosevelt's hide, Godkin went on, "Now, in our opinion, no man, and especially no man of Mr. Roosevelt's bellicose temperament, is qualified to give advice about war who has not seen war. The sight of a battlefield is one of the most awful lessons in international ethics which a civilized man can receive. Before Mr. Roosevelt sends round the fiery cross among the young men of the country any more, he ought, therefore, to have some personal experience of his own nostrum." Fighting grizzly bears, we can tell him, is child's play compared to facing a battery or storming a fortification. That he would fight like a demon under Kruger, we have no doubt, but he ought to fight somewhere before he recommends fighting so glibly to our youth. Roosevelt admitted to hours of deep depression in his job, together with much nervous fatigue as he struggled to break the deadlock at Mulberry Street.
What can I have done? What can I have done that any man should imagine I could succumb to this hell-born lure?
Commissioners Grant and Andrews were also anxious to promote the two acting inspectors, but Parker continued to object, and Chief Conlon continued to side with him. The deadlock began to look like permanent paralysis. There was no hope of getting remedial legislation through Boss Platt. Grant went to beg his aid and was politely refused.
I would like to please you, Colonel Grant, but I don't care nearly as much to please you as I do to worry Roosevelt.
The old man was obviously looking forward to Roosevelt's early resignation. Grant angrily declared that he would vote for no further promotions until Brooks and McCullough were confirmed. This only worsened the strain on the president of the board.
Though I have the constitution of a bull moose, he wrote on 30 March, it is beginning to wear on me a little.
Later that same day, he, Grant, and Andrews made a sudden move to bypass Boss Platt. They jointly petitioned the New York State Legislature to scrap the Bipartisan Act. In its place, the commissioners proposed a bill that would first enable a majority of three to override a minority of two, and second, restore to the board the independent rights of assignment now enjoyed by Chief Conlon. Roosevelt still had plenty of contacts in Albany, and the new police bill came up for consideration within 48 hours. Machine Republicans were too slow to organize against it, and a favorable vote was recorded in the Assembly. Parker moved at once to work up opposition in the Senate. He wrote to warn Boss Platt that Roosevelt was an incorrigible promoter of Democratic policemen. To give the president of the police board more power, therefore, would actually reduce Platt's chances of patronage in the upper ranks. Parker went on to say that he himself was just the opposite, a Democratic commissioner who happened to recommend Republican officers. In proof of this statement, he enclosed a list of recent promotions, showing that Roosevelt had favored every Democratic candidate to date. The list was forwarded to Albany, and Platt's faithful lieutenant, Smooth Ed Lauterbach, circulated it among Republican members of the Senate. Roosevelt did not see a copy until 9 April, when he arrived to testify on behalf of his bill before the Senate Committee on Cities. He boggled at the neatly typed document. It was unqualifiedly false in almost every particular. Worse still was Parker's insinuation that politics played a part in the advancement process at Mulberry Street. Roosevelt neither knew nor cared which party any policeman he liked belonged to. He conceived of promotion strictly in terms of merit. Pouncing upon Lauterbach in the Senate corridor, he began to tick off the list's falsehoods one by one, whereupon Parker, who had also been invited to testify, joined them and insisted they were all true. Both commissioners were quivering with anger when they adjourned to the nearby hearing room. In their respective testimonies for and against the police bill, they made a study of opposites. Roosevelt barking like a nervous bulldog, Parker feline and purringly sarcastic. The effect of some of his remarks was such that Roosevelt several times leaped up and paced around the room in a vain effort to stay calm.
Of course, Parker drawled after quoting a newspaper attack on himself, given out by some unidentified source at Mulberry Street. I don't attribute that part of the article to Mr. Roosevelt.
Oh, you may, Roosevelt shot back.
His truculence at Albany cost him dear. Although he sent Senate Republicans a convincing rebuttal of Parker's charges, signed by both Andrews and Grant, the police bill was reported unfavorably. To add insult to injury, another letter bomb was waiting for Roosevelt when he got back to headquarters. Had it not been intercepted and defused by detectives, its charge of fine black Chinese gunpowder might have blown his face off. Now that Roosevelt and Parker had made a public spectacle of their hatred for each other, they no longer attempted to conceal it from their colleagues, nor from the force, nor from the reporters who twice weekly attended open sessions of the police board. Consequently, the Mulberry Street affair became something of a running entertainment for New Yorkers. The popular press treated it as a circulation-boosting suspense serial and described every new flare-up at headquarters with shrewd attention to dramatic detail. The Sun warned its readers to look out for epithets. The row in the police board approaches the danger point. While the Evening News wondered when Montague Park